Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And you can tell by that weary sigh that we're very much looking forward to this week's episodes. I mean, it's not the show's fault. It's season 13, as we have established with our meta talk about the lawsuit way back in the past. You got to remember, this is being recorded just weeks after the lawsuit was announced. But mm-hmm. We all know they had a lot on their mind when they were doing these episodes. And it shows, because I swear to God, like, I know that, like, I remember the clown episode pretty well, because it's about a murderous clown. But it's like, I watched the other two episodes yesterday, and I'll be honest with you, they go in and out of your head just almost instantaneously.
Except for one thing.
Oh, right? I can't wait to find out the one thing that interested you.
Well, it's just that as I'm watching these things.
Yeah.
Right? The first one that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
I would be talking about this very differently if this hadn't been just a few weeks after the lawsuit became public knowledge.
Yeah, I know.
Because I watched this. And I'm just going. I have this theory. So we're talking about Last Gasp. And yeah. I could just talk about before we talk about it, because it is Last Gasp. It's this episode.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this and I'm going, okay, so the theory would be that the one guy got fired. And then there was a whole bunch of anonymous complaints about
behavior,
about idiot.
Hey, you know what? Innocent until proven guilty. So maybe don't just ad hominem attack people. There were a number of reports and complaints about this person. Continue.
About the DP.
Yes, I know.
Okay. And so I'm sitting there going, okay, fit this into the timeline. So, and then there was this internal investigation, which I don't really have a timeline for, but certainly it's over.
Yeah.
By the time these are airing. So maybe it was even over earlier, because that's the sense you get from the lawsuit.
Yeah.
And so it was even earlier. So they felt free to fire the second guy who's named in the lawsuit, the second plaintiff.
Right.
And I'm going, and I'm watching, and I'm thinking, well, maybe they weren't supposed to shoot the person in false flag. Maybe they restructured the rest of this season or these bunch of episodes to mirror what was going on in their own, you know, to justify.
No, okay? You're wrong. I can guarantee you're wrong about that simply because.
Well, I know, but
no, you're 100% wrong about that just because. The episode False Flag doesn't make sense if they don't shoot that guy. Because there's no conceivable reason for the man to have shot himself. Like, obviously he was supposed to get shot by them. And that broke the whole rest of the... And the... No, they were always going to do the investigation. And the only question we have is whether that investigation was something they, you know, conceived for the season without knowing that they were an investigation by HR... And it was just serendipitous, or whether, wow, I got to say serendipitous. That felt pretty good. Or whether they specifically, what do you call it? The investigation started earlier than we realize, right? And they were talking about doing something about this kind of interrogation over the summer. And that's the thing we don't know, and hopefully we'll find out in the future, like exactly how early they knew that this thing was starting. But 100% the audit was always going to happen this year.
The internal investigation was much earlier.
So there you go.
It started before the 2018 guy got killed. Got fired, I am sure.
Oh no, so there you go. I mean, so yes, it was clearly influenced by stuff they were going through in real life. And again, Obviously, I don't know who said they can't shoot this guy, but somebody said that, and that's what broke the plot. Because this is an entire episode about the aftermath of them getting split up. And it's yet another time when they do, just like when Derek healed, it's another time when they do a time jump, but then, like, the rest of the season won't reflect that they did a time jump.
I know.
Yeah, it's like, it's 2 months later. And they haven't been working on a case the entire time? Like, that is one of the strangest parts of this episode, is the idea that she would keep them just sitting around not working on cases.
Okay, I should read the synopsis.
Oh yeah, read the synopsis, please.
Yeah, in the wake of Barnes' attempt to restructure the BAU...
It's not an attempt, she does restructure the BAU. That's... Not a... Okay. Weird way to frame that, but please continue. Sorry.
Well, if she had... She attempted...
did restructure.
Just a minute. She was attempting a couple of episodes ago, and then she did it.
Yeah, but that's not how you phrase that.
Well, of course not.
Yeah, but don't defend this person. Just continue with the thing.
Oh, no. I wasn't defending this person. I was saying... And it's in wake of Barnes' restructuring of the BAU.
That's my point.
Yes, I know.
The BAU has been restructured. So continue with the thing.
Would you just...
Continue.
Divided team works behind her back to track down and identify a serial abductor who photographs high-class call girls from Washington, D.C., before shooting them and incinerating their bodies.
Ugh. Yeah, so this is a particularly just unpleasant episode. But at the same time, as I was talking about last week, it's also one of their few attempts to do comedy ever. And I have to believe this is born out of Adam Rodriguez coming onto the show and be like, why is no one talking about how ridiculous this show is? You know?
Yeah.
So you've got, again, you've got the, so they try to throw in our face the idea that Penelope is allowed to have a computer room all to herself filled with bizarre tchotchkes. It's like, no, it's the FBI. She's supposed to be a professional. Why are none of these professional? And then you have David Rossi in probably the best scene maybe of the year, complaining about the way a man looks, like the whole, like the completely non-authentic way a guy is behaving who's pretending to be an FBI agent. I say pretending. He's an actor who's playing an FBI agent. And, I mean, it has to be Adam Rodriguez talking about it. The man is dressed exactly like Spencer Reed. Like, the joke is that this guy looks nothing like an FBI agent. And he's dressed exactly like Spencer Reed.
I know. Hair and the whole thing.
No, the hair, the three-piece suit.
Yeah.
The fact that he has a revolver strapped at the front of his pants. Like, he's dressed exactly like Spencer Reed.
Actually, he's dressed better than Spencer Reed.
Oh, no, yes, he's a better dressed version. Yes. He's
good looking suit.
Yeah, he's a handsomer, better dressed Spencer Reed. But the point is, 100%. And then you have to imagine him saying, why is it that everyone acts like Spencer Reed doesn't look like a male model? Like, no one ever reacts to the fact that he's literally a male model. He's a shockingly handsome man, and this is the first time that gets acknowledged in 13 years of the show, when tons of men and women come to his course just to look at Spencer Reed for an hour.
I know, the whole thing, I mean,
it's hilarious.
Just
it's literally hilarious. This is why I think it's Adam Rodriguez just going, what show am I on? Because I feel like it takes an outsider who, like, wasn't on the show for the first 12 years to come on and just be able to, as a director, point out how absurd so many aspects of this show are. right down to referencing the other completely absurd and unrealistic show about the FBI, The X-Files. There's even a joke about that the X-Files. No, it's the best. Is it? Okay.
It's
you might
so
think
good.
That. Is that better? I mean, my favorite part of the episode is the guy who's dressed exactly like Spencer Reed being held up as an object of ridicule. Is your favorite scene in the episode the scenes with Mulder and Scully?
I don't know. I think the better one is the one where David Rossi, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
The one that you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
the guy. Yeah, the little vignette of the guy, you know, pretending.
Yeah,
the performer. I mean, that is. But then Spencer, like, they're all just hilarious.
They're funny scenes.
You know, as you say, this is the, Adam Rodriguez must have, the one thing that came out to me when I was watching these episodes, but particularly this one, is I would love to see the script.
I know. How much of it was the director? Yeah. How much of it was already there in the script? I feel like it has to be mostly Adam Rodriguez.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. They've never done, like, this is a show completely unwilling to do comedy at all. So whether it was his ideas on the day, or whether he developed this script specifically when he found out he got to direct an episode, right? Whether he developed it himself or it was in the script already, I think it has to play into his status as an outsider. He's the only one that can point out it's a emperor has no clothes situation where only a complete outsider can poke fun at the absurdity of this world, can clearly see how ridiculous all of this is.
Well, and you have to wonder, since he didn't get fired at the end of the season.
Oh, no, I'm sure they had a sense of humor about it. I hope.
Yeah, well, I've not given them a lot of
credit for that.
For sense of humor in this.
No, that's true. In the show, generally.
Generally speaking, I'm sitting here going, I don't know. Everything is.
Well, you don't see a lot of evidence of it. I agree with that.
You know, in any of this, everything is taken so seriously.
Yeah. No. Period. It's everything is serious as a heart attack all of the time.
Mm-hmm. But this one, I mean, the whole thing with Penelope. No, you're only allowed 3 personal items.
I know.
You know, and then I love the little girl across the hall. But anyway, you know, this is what it means to really work as an FBI agent, right?
Exactly. She's been living in a fantasy world this whole time, and suddenly she's got to face that, you know, her experience is not what it is like to work at the FBI.
Yeah.
You've been living in a fantasy world with your toys and your family and whatnot, and that's not what the FBI is generally. You know? So I like that.
Yeah, but I did love the Mulder and Scully. I have to.
Oh no, that's hilarious. That's such a good scene.
Yeah. Well, the two scenes with them, right?
I know. Oh,
at the end.
So
well, I guess she's not coming.
All right. Well, we got an hour to ourselves then. That's so beautiful.
I know.
Oh, it's such, no, I mean, it's very funny. And it's just, it's so weird that the comedy episode, the episode where they like make jokes and satirize criminal minds and like the Adam Rodriguez outsider stuff happens, is also just one of the most unpleasant episodes of Criminal Minds of the season. Because you talk about them dropping away from the sexual motivation of 99% of serial killers. And they have. They've done many episodes without touching that on at all. You're absolutely right. And then with this one, it comes back in a hurry.
Oh, Lord.
Because this is an episode, spoiler alert, about a guy so sexually obsessed with his stepsister that he murdered her and now is trying to recreate that over and over again. That's the plot of this episode. And it's deeply unpleasant to watch.
It's horrible.
Like, no, it's a horrific episode. Like, these women getting held in basements and tortured and brutalized and shot, and the fact that he turns the whole thing into an elaborate photo staging thing. Like, everything about this is just one of the most unpleasant episodes. And then at the same time, zany comedy. You know, the only comedy that doesn't land is they don't really... The whole...
The first one.
Emily. Yeah, the whole Emily the working with OPR doesn't really land at all. Just kind of seems like you're
because
crapping all over sex workers. Thanks for that.
Yeah, because she takes it too seriously.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, and that's exactly right. Like, she takes it too seriously.
Yeah, she pulls the David Caruso. So it doesn't work.
So it doesn't work. And everyone else is having fun. And it's not so absurd that you can make fun of the fact that she's taking it too seriously like you would with a David Caruso. Oh, David Caruso, we love you. Don't ever change. But anyway, it's interesting. And then you have to face up the ridiculous idea that they would put, like, the woman who is most likely to abuse her power in the OPR. Like, if you're punishing Emily, don't put her in the Office of Professional Review. Like, she is not qualified to call out other people on their stuff.
As was pointed out to her.
Yeah. It's just
you must have done something real bad to end up here.
I know. I mean,
the other cop.
Yeah.
Certainly is playing it, you know. I mean,
he's playing
the rest
it, right.
of them seem to be playing it almost as if it's a comedy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're just way too over the top because.
Of course.
I'm sorry. IPR wouldn't look like that in the FBI.
Yeah. No. OPR is not like guys in cheap suits sitting around outside hotels.
Like,
No, they're imagining what IA looks like in a cheesy movie. And if she had run with that in her performance, the way everybody else kind of runs with their thing, I think it would have been more fun and more accurate.
Yeah, and but who knows what Rodriguez told him, though, eh?
That's true. You're right. I mean,
if you think about it, Aisha Tyler's character also takes her job seriously.
That's true.
And it's everything
but she's just
going
in a very
her.
Ridiculous situation.
Yeah, she's in a ridiculous situation.
Yeah, and and you're right. I guess had they made the situation more ridiculous, like, then her being straight-faced could have been... that could have played better as comedy. But the situation is just like a guy has hired a sex worker.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, that's the whole thing. He's supposed to be on duty, but he's with a prostitute. Okay. Is that supposed to shock me or offend me or me find that absurd? That's not an unusual thing, guys.
The thing is, and the point is that they should have made it more absurd.
Yeah. Bigger and more outlandish.
Yeah,
right. It would have played better.
To make it might have played better, and if Emily was going to take it straight down, right? But anyway, it doesn't matter.
Big and rough.
As far as I'm concerned, Adam Rodriguez probably got away with what he could get away with.
Yeah, and no, I mean, way to go, Adam Rodriguez, for this episode.
Yeah.
Like, thing is, there's no notable visual style to it, right?
No.
There's no notable visual style. It doesn't use music in an interesting thing. I don't think he's a, he has given me no sign that he's an incredibly talented director with visuals or actors. Like, there's no great acting moments in this. But it's so much more for at least half of the episode, it's so much more playful than any previous episode had been.
Yeah.
You know, and I love to see that. I really do.
It's like,
it's a ton of fun.
And we don't want it. Yes. And we've already said everything to say about the other case, except the end, right? With this team working behind the back because Barnes gets her comeuppance in this episode.
Yeah.
Because they managed to save the senator's daughter.
Yep.
And of course, it's the daughter of the senator who's in charge of their funding.
An amazing coincidence, huh?
Oh, my Lord.
What an unbelievable contrivance.
You know, oh, wow. And now they get to come back together again.
I know. I mean, it's sweet, but it's also incredibly contrived.
incredibly contrived.
Yeah, like, even by the standards of, you know, a mediocre TV show, it's very contrived.
Yes, it's almost a situation comedy contrivance.
Yeah, it's that, you're right, it's that level of absurd that, in an amazing coincidence, the woman that they're risking their careers to save just happens to be the daughter of the guy who's in charge of their funding and is the only person who can stand up to Barnes. What a happy coincidence for him. It's like, guys, did you set up this kidnapping? Because it worked out really well for you.
Okay, so when did Les Moonves go down?
I think 2018. Yeah.
Probably in the fall of 2018.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so he was still the senator saving the team.
Over and over again, yeah.
Well, no, this show, because there had to have been complaints.
Oh, absolutely.
There were, because there are 12 plaintiffs.
I know. Okay, but I mean, stop. Look, let's.
I'm sorry.
I agree with you, but I'm just saying. I know. I'm just saying. I agree with you. But you shouldn't read everything through the lens of the lawsuit.
I can't help it.
I know. It's hard not to. I'm saying make an effort.
Yeah, well, I'm
not
trying
to look at everything. It's tough. I mean, when you know this stuff, you can't unknow it. But we're not here to review a lawsuit. We're here to review a TV show. And we're here to, on some level, we have to talk about the world. Yeah, we're going to talk about production. But at the same time, we do have to kind of engage with the world of the show. And the lawsuit is well outside our mandate in that respect. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, so we'll do another Tuesday episode.
Because you can talk. Well, no, at the end of the season, I'm sure we'll talk about how the it seems like the lawsuit has implicated it. But anyway, so yeah, it's funny because it's very strange because the killer, their leap, I guess it kind of makes sense, but it seems at the same time like a bit of a contrived leap that they're able to say, oh, well, he took the sex workers he hired to this hotel. So he must have an emotional connection to that hotel. And that's quite a leap because we are told within the episode that this hotel is where every rich guy in Washington, D.C. takes his paramours, mistresses, professionals. Call girls, right? So it they establish that this is the place in DC where power brokers always take. So the idea that the killer, I mean, they know he's an upper class guy just because he has access to this world, right? That makes perfect sense. But the idea that he also must have an emotional connection to the place, like, that is a completely out of left field kind of statement. Like, there's no basis for that at all. And it's kind of a cheat, especially since it turns out that, oh, they were 100% right. He did have an emotional connection to the place. That's where he murdered the stepsister he was in love with. And so, like, the only significant thing that ever happened at the hotel was this rich girl OD'd there, apparently. So they were immediately able to lock onto him in what I would call a very preposterous twist. Like, that they're able to lock onto him that easily because of that seems very, very preposterous.
I'm just not engaging with these episodes, but yes, it does seem preposterous. Let's move on to the Capilanos.
No, before we do, I just want to say that, we'll move on to the Capilanos in a second. Before we do, I just want to say that, yeah, the thing that really gets me is that, like, I know that Barnes's job was to cover up for what happened to somebody, and, like, she works as a politician, right? So that's her job, and she completely understands that. But it's, like, the fact that there was a woman who was broke, right, and was having sex with men for drugs, how on earth, how bad at your job do you have to be to go to the room where this woman had been, had died of an overdose while having sex with men for drugs, and she was completely broke, and there is a $20,000 bottle of wine on the side of the thing?
And she missed it.
And how do you miss that? When we see the label is, like, literally covered in dust. how could you have missed that? Like, I know she's a political person, and I know she doesn't care that much about a job. This is like an ancient bottle of wine sitting there. And I know they have to have a clue that's easy enough for the team to solve, and that's why it's there, but it's so over the top that it would be a $20,000 bottle of wine that you'd have to ask, even if you were just phoning in your job as the person investigating this this death. You still would notice the $20,000 bottle of wine. And I don't believe you couldn't. All right, I'll stop now. Let's move on to the Capilanos.
No, but then I have to respond to that because that just proves how contrived this whole episode is.
No, it is. It really is. Good thing. And I want to make it clear. I said a lot of nice things about this episode.
Yeah.
The only thing we're complimenting, and I hope I can speak for you here, is Adam Rodriguez's cheeky deconstruction of some of the more ridiculous parts of the show.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only thing we're actually complimenting.
Yeah. Yes, and that was enjoyable.
It really is. And it's probably going to be my favorite episode of the season, just for that.
Well, it's just because
Scully and Mulder is very funny. Yes.
Is ultimately, of all of them, that's the funniest.
Oh, absolutely. Although, again, the show admitting that Reed looks like a male model is pretty funny, too.
Yes.
All right, let's get to it. Second episode, The Capilanos.
In Guymon, Oklahoma, when a man is stabbed to death during a home invasion and his 7-year-old son claims a man dressed as a circus clown killed him, the BAU attempts to determine if the child's statement is true or not. No,
they figure that out right away. But yeah.
Right away, because Reed just says, okay, it's so detailed that it has to be true.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it's just too detailed.
Exactly. Like a kid wouldn't imagine that detailed a clown. All right, so some context. This is an episode based on a YouTube video. I don't know if you're familiar with this YouTube video. Probably not, given your lack of response. So what happened was there was this YouTube video that purports to be a kid being put to bed by their parent, right? And well, I mean, that is what it's a video of. And it's supposed to be like nanny cam footage of the room to look after the kid. And so the daddy puts the kid to bed, blah, 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 blah. And then once all of that has happened, the frame is still for like 10 seconds. And then a clown appears from under the bed. Right. And so that's the creepy footage. And so, you know, it went around creepypasta spooking people on the internet. And so they made this episode based on that very short internet video. In case you're wondering what the origin of this was, that is what the origin of this was. Okay. So now you know the origin. Why isn't this episode creepier? They do a second Killer Clown episode because we all remember they did a Killer Clown episode before, but that episode was compromised because it wasn't really a Killer Clown episode. It was their Killer Santa episode, but the strike kept them from actually doing a Killer Santa episode because they were on hiatus over Christmas. And they wanted to pretend, so they just like, okay, well, he just dressed as a clown. But it was actually their Killer Santa episode, right?
Yes.
Right down to him leaving them gifts every year.
Yes.
Like, it was 100% supposed to be the Killer Santa episode of Criminal Minds. And this episode is the Killer Clown episode, and it's not a horror episode at all. It is literally just a character drama.
Yeah.
Like, it's a character drama about these two brothers in a toxic relationship dealing with the aftermath of their father's abuse of them.
Yeah.
And it's such a weird thing for Matt Gubler, of all people, to be doing.
Well, Erica wrote it, so.
Yeah. But, you know.
But the impression that I get, the impression that I get is that Matt overrides writers.
Yeah.
I mean, his relationship with Breen Fraser. Yeah. That one that where you had the two of them talking and Breen is talking and about how Matthew basically changed a lot of the script.
Yes.
Okay. And explained to Breen how it would be better. And then Breen is arguing with him, but Matthew overrides him. And then Breen says, well, yeah, Matt Gubler was right.
He's such a talented director.
Okay, so all I can say is that Erica Messer is the showrunner, and she wrote this episode.
And he can't override the showrunner. Yeah.
And so when he wants, because when you look at that opening where you get the clown coming out from under the bed, which makes no sense.
No, it doesn't at all.
In the context of the entire episode, that makes no sense.
Nope.
Because that's not what happened, because the little boy is in bed with his father. Because he's
like,
scared.
Why would this guy, like, he would, like, why would he hide under a bed in a child's room when his whole thing is getting into fist fights or stabbing the dads when they come home?
Well, no, it's not just that. Maybe, but he goes into the bed.
Yeah.
Like, he's under the father's bed. It's not the child's
room. Oh, you're right.
Room.
Yeah, he's under the father's bed. I was thinking of the internet video.
Yeah, no. So he's under the,
yeah, he's under the father's out. Bed.
And then it goes to the music and everything,
exactly.
Right?
The opening titles.
And then it goes nowhere from there, because it turns out that the kid was in his room, and I'm going, how the hell did he get in his room?
Yeah.
And you see the father and the clown fighting. Like, I'm taking this out of sequence, right? The father and the and the clown, right?
Yeah.
So in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And then there's some comment about how, well, the father moved it there so the son wouldn't see it. Well, I'm going, okay, just cut it. I
know.
It doesn't make much sense. I mean, this has the potential to be a very sad episode.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it is a sad episode, you know?
It's a very sad episode, because one guy is trying, like, in their own way, both guys are trying to get over...
Yeah.
The brutal abuse they suffered as children. Like, it's both men are attempting to get past this, and one of them is attempting to do it in a much healthier way than the other by being a good father himself, and the other one is so trapped by the abuse, he can't get out of it, and the one guy can't let his brother go, so he gets pulled into it tragically. Like, as a drama, it completely works.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That part of it works, even to the point of the two now fatherless children.
Yes.
Drawing stuff
together in a very, like, just sad, sad, sad ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That stuff all works. But I guess the reason I, you know, recoil slightly from it is that I'm like, it just doesn't, so much of it doesn't feel like an episode. Like, I'm not even saying it's a bad episode. Like, it's a perfectly good episode that's just a drama about these two guys. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm not sure why the team is there. Yeah. I'm not sure why this is a Criminal Minds episode. Does that make sense?
No. It's a short story about, it's like a one-off about these, these children about these two men and, you know, their relationship and the daughter and the son and the fact that their livelihood has now disappeared underneath them, you know. And it's nice to have the business about the these kind of circuses that are off the
off the books, so to speak.
Like, there's a whole bunch
and only when we get to the episode. By the way, only when we get to the off the books, that scene where we get to the off the books rodeo.
Circus, right? Rodeo.
Do we actually finally get the other Matt Gubler trademark, which is we get some fun music for the first time in the episode.
I know.
Yeah, the music, like, it had been completely devoid of Matt Gubler's trademark music up until that point, which is disappointing.
Anybody could have. Other than that, like that first beginning where the clown comes out from under the bed and you have
anyone could
some
have directed
potential.
This episode. Yeah.
Because when you see the picture,
yeah,
right, that the boy draws, it certainly is not the clown that came out from under the bed.
No, of course not. No.
Right? And so you had the potential for something, but it would have been a very different episode. And this is just, again, it's a well-written sort of episode about this poor family, but it's not certainly, it's a perfunctory. Why the BAU is
why
there?
Are they there? That's what I'm getting. Because it crossed
state lines, so the BAU gets to go in.
Exactly. Well, and one of the things that gets me about it, right, is that he, and this, I don't want this to be too harsh, but it's like, and fundamentally, it's one of those episodes where they didn't need to show up because the son, I mean, I guess having a psychologist to interview the son, but it's like, is important. But the minute you hear that he was dressed like a clown and smelled like hay and horses, you know, he's a rodeo clown.
Yeah.
And then later that day, or the later the next day, because the kills another family. Like, so later the next day, we go and there's video footage of them trying to rob somebody.
Yeah.
And shooting him with his own gun. Right?
Yeah.
And so you're left with this situation where, okay, well, that's not. And so they just drop by the, what do you call it? Well, they just drop by the local rodeo. And it's like, do you know these guys? And they're like, yep, that's these guys. Everybody knows those guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's not hard to catch them at all. And the reason I think that bothers me so much.
Well, they try and make it. They try and make it seem as if it's more difficult because you have to have Daniel asking about these off-the-books rodeos, right?
Yeah, and it's like, I love that they have to, they add that as a second thing. It's like, wait a minute. Maybe, they're like, I had the brilliant idea to ask if there's somewhere these guys might be able to find work. And I'm like, yeah, I think everybody would have thought that, Daniel. Like, it's not your special insight that makes you go back and say, is there anywhere they might be able to pick up some work?
Yeah, because
anybody would ask that question, wouldn't they?
Don't you know that they're the two brothers? Yeah. It is, no, the local cops would have figured this one out easily
enough.
Almost
immediately. Themselves. Yeah.
I have no idea why they're there, why this episode was created. I mean, it should have been done completely differently.
Yeah.
Like, I would think
you
something.
Wasted a killer clown episode on just a sad drama about a broken
family. And it is. And it is the actors.
Oh, yeah.
All of them are extremely effective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I can't. That problem.
We're not faulting
just,
this part of the episode. We're not
no,
even
it's
we're
just
not faulting
it,
most of the episode. But
yeah, putting
what is it,
it
doing in this context?
Yeah. You know, you're putting it in this world. Well, yeah. There's something just missing from this
yeah.
episode.
Well, no, but it's like, I guess, in
like,
a way, it really does play with our preconceptions, right? That they did a Killer Clown episode, and the Killer Clown episode is a slow drama about child abuse. You know, like, that is a strange innovation. Like, there's an interesting concept there that they completely, they did something so completely away from what we were expecting them to do with Killer Clowns. Like, I get that that is different and it is
maybe
in, you know, in quotes, interesting, but I would agree. I think you would agree with me at the same time that it's like, not what we're A, not what we're expecting. And B, not the most interesting episode to do as a killer clown. Because fundamentally, it's not that complicated a story. And like you said, it's about, it's just this drama about these two brothers and their emotional connection to one another. And how the one brother should let the other brother go because he's just ruining his life. But he can't do it because they were in, both of them were in Nam together, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
You know? It's like to, I mean, we all saw Justified, they dug coal, you know, and it just comes down to that. They have an unbreakable connection because they both suffered the same thing.
Yes.
And as you say, there's this question of whether that plays out with the children of the guy and the children of the victim, because yeah. then you see those two matched, these two people who have both lost their fathers in this yeah. horrific way. I mean, there's another kid out there who lost both their parents who isn't really touched on.
Well, there, but that's
yeah,
there
that's a whole
pair
other
there. That's
yeah.
a pair. That's
You're right,
a pair
that's,
of children.
So they'll be.
And
they'll be
I
fine.
Still, I never understood why he killed the wife.
Yeah, I mean, even if she was trying to defend the husband, you could just club her and leave.
Yeah, you know? there was no reason because he wouldn't want to be like his father.
Exactly.
So why would he kill the woman?
Yeah.
You know,
and if he did kill the woman, why doesn't he have a greater why doesn't he have greater psychological trauma related to that when we see him again? Because if he's killing this woman, well, he's becoming more like his father who he hates. So that should have accelerated his breakdown. But you're right, it doesn't.
It doesn't, you know, and he, you know, I mean, because we're clearly told that the father killed the mother.
Oh, yeah. So no, that's right there in the episode.
Yeah. So
why is that more shocking to him? We should have been
a bigger devolution.
Yeah, after he did that. But after he does that, there's nothing. He tries to rob a house and then he, you know, then they run away and then they get caught. Like, that's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. I didn't think about that. But the killing the wife should have been like a turning point for this guy. Yeah. Yeah, it might have been in the script. Yeah.
Well, it should have been an earlier one because it doesn't really make, like, you don't get a sense, like, it's a sad story, and yet you don't get any sense that going to try and do this rich man doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because it doesn't make any emotion, like, it doesn't have the emotional resonance that all of the earlier crimes did. Yeah, it's during the day. It's a guy who's a rich guy who they're going to rob just for the money, but there's an extra level to it for the brother. And you don't get the sense that he's trying to, like, you never get the sense that he's trying to appease his brother. At this point, it's become about the murder for him, and yet they don't really sell the idea that, oh, well, I'll just appease my brother by doing this rich guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't play.
Yeah, it doesn't play right. Again, what I would say is that this is the first draft, and there was a key of an idea, and somehow or another it should have been worked on. Like, and you know, it's just that this is another one of those episodes where you have weird little vignettes in the episode.
Yeah.
That work. But the episode as a whole doesn't work.
No, that's absolutely right.
You know, like Reed with the little boy.
Oh, I like that scene.
You know, it works so well. Yeah. Both of the scenes when he's in the hospital room work so well. But the episode as a whole, there's something missing from it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, as sad as it is, it doesn't. If it wasn't for that end scene with those two children, it wouldn't land emotionally at all. And it should, because it's such a sad story.
Yeah.
And I can't even tell you what it focuses on instead, but there's something fundamentally missing in this episode that is really hard to put my finger on. And maybe someday it will come to me, but remember, I had this problem with an earlier episode that you had. It was like a bunch of little vignettes and then stuck together to make an episode.
Yeah.
And
no, I do remember that.
And somehow or another, and I just, if I could remember exactly which one, I, you know, to see who it was written by.
Yeah, you could say if this is a theme for them.
I don't think it was Full Tilt Boogie.
Full Tilt Boogie was the episode about Oxy that was so terrible.
Oh, that was so terrible. Yeah, the Ox. Although even that had that. Even that one, though, if you think about it.
Yeah. What about it?
Full Tilt Boogie. It's just it's bits and pieces. That felt like more like an earlier, like a draft. Like many of these episodes feel like drafts as opposed to full finished product. Yeah.
No, that's true. I agree with that completely.
And I think and we're getting close to the end of the year. We've only got two more episodes this year.
Yes.
So
both us.
For season 13. Show. No.
Four more episodes in the episode. Yeah.
No.
Four more episodes in the season.
Well, there are four more episodes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Two of ours. Yeah. But I'm talking about the episode, not about us.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. All right, so let's move on to our final episode of the night.
The Dance of Love.
An episode that you forget the minute you're done watching it.
and starring one of our most favorite people.
Oh, absolutely. We love Jason Gedrick. He was the boy who could fly. He was the star of Iron Eagle. And far more importantly, he was the star of Murder One.
I know.
One of the all-time great TV shows. And then they tried to do a second season. It didn't really work at all.
No, and then there was another show that he was on that only got, what, 10 episodes or 12
episodes?
Oh,
Falcone. Oh, my God. With him and Joe Pantoliano. Oh, such an incredible show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that was such an amazing show. One of my favorite crime shows just ever. It's about a guy who if you could see it somehow, you absolutely owe it to yourself. He played a guy who gets out of jail and he's trying to put his life right. And he's, essentially forced by the FBI to go undercover with Joe Pantoliano. Right, yeah. To be their mole in Joe Pantoliano's organization, and it just gets better and better and better the further it goes. And it didn't last long, because it belonged on cable. It did not belong on network television.
Jason Gedrick was wonderful. It was very dark.
Yeah.
It really was.
My favorite show like that is the one that, oh god, I'm blanking his name. He plays Captain Pike on Discovery now. But it was a very, very fun show. And I'm trying to remember the title of that one. And, It was the same premise. It was the exact same premise about an undercover person, although this time he was actually a cop going undercover. And in that one, the mob boss was played by, are you ready for this? David Paymer.
Really?
Playing a mob boss. It was quite an against type thing, and he was fantastic. But then again, I just love David Paymer.
Okay.
All right, so that's about David Paymer. Let's get to the episode.
When two women in Chicago, Illinois, are stabbed to death on consecutive nights and found with a red rose in their mouths, the BAU searches for a serial killer with unexpected motives. Meanwhile, Rossi takes personal time off after receiving a phone call from his third ex-wife, Crystal, with two L's, as they point out.
Over and over again.
And a K.
Yeah. Oh, Crystal. So Joe Mantegna directed this episode, and it has that Joe Mantegna characteristic complete lack of any style. Like, he is a man who makes perfunctory television.
Well, what he does is he takes the script and he films the script just as it's written.
Exactly. That's all. There is no visual flair. There are no interesting character moments. All you can guarantee, like, the only thing you can guarantee about a Joe Mantegna episode is that David Rossi will have a chance to look like a good dude. Like, you'll come away from the episode thinking, that David Rossi's a good dude. And that's exactly what they do this time, as he stands up to a wife abuser and threatens him with extrajudicial torture and murder.
Yeah.
I think we all know what happened here. They wanted David Rossi to get remarried and do a story about that. And he should have remarried his, first wife. She was his first wife. And then his second wife is the one who died of cancer. Well, suicide, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. She was it cancer? Yeah. You know what? It's not important to the story whether it was cancer or not. But yes, that's the second wife, I believe, because this is the wife. Hayden's the one he married right after getting back from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And they had a secret daughter. And what happened was the woman who played the daughter got a sitcom. And so she wasn't going to be able to be on Criminal Minds much anymore. So they decided to do the David gets remarried, blah, 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 with his third wife. And I'm a little sad about that, because I really liked what they were trying to do with him and Hayden and him trying to change as a person.
Yeah.
Like, I think they were touching on something interesting there. They didn't do it perfectly, because they had him go through the same emotional journey multiple times. Like, it wasn't perfect, but for Criminal Minds, grading on the Criminal Minds scale... They tried. Like, they really tried to do something interesting with David, and I'm not gonna downplay that. They really did try. And that first episode with his daughter, You know, he gets that wonderful moment of being like, maybe I wouldn't have been able to be there for you. I probably wouldn't have.
Yeah.
She was probably right to not tell me about you. And that's that's a heartbreaking moment. And he played it so well. And it's such a good episode. And nothing that happens with Crystal in any way comes close to touching that level of drama.
Oh, it can't. They got drunk. They got married. They got the marriage annulled.
Exactly. Like, fundamentally, these are not... Line... Okay. Yeah, please.
Funniest line in this episode is Penelope Garcia going, gotta up my game.
I know. How did I miss this?
Well, I mean, that's my line. If I ever get married for a third time, it will be in Las Vegas with an Elvis personator. I have... That's just it. Because that is just, you know... Okay, that is perfectly ludicrous. So if I ever meet a man
and decide to get married again, the context. I know, right?
But
that
would
be the context in which you do it.
Someone who would understand why I want to go to Las Vegas and get married by an Elvis personator. I would rather get married by David Rache playing an Elvis personator.
Well, that would be the ideal situation.
That would be ideal, but, you know, I'll put up with just an Elvis personator. And I was too late for Elvis. I mean, Elvis was not a big part of my growing up.
No.
But never mind.
You get it.
I get it. You know,
it's Elvis.
Yeah, it's Elvis. The greatest, I would say that he is probably better than even Frankie Boy.
Oh, Frank's just as a performer. Just as a performer.
The ability that he has with a song, but, you know, I mean, is to what he wrenches out of a song is just amazing, right? Yeah. You know, anyway, that's a whole other podcast.
No, it is. We're not here to talk about Elvis, but it's true. I mean,
well, it's not just Elvis. It's
the culture of Elvis.
Yeah, but I just have to say this because we'll never do a podcast about this.
Of course not.
What really pisses me off is this idea that somehow or another there's something wrong with you if you are not a singer-songwriter.
I know. He was just a performer.
Just the denigration of some of, like, Frank Sinatra, he was a scum.
Yep.
That
complete
man
scumbag.
But that man knew how to sing a song, and that man, and he knew how to pick it. The point is being able to pick the song that's going to work, or being able to give that song something. I have listened to so many singer-songwriters who can't sing worth a damn, and they can't sing their own material. I mean, there are exceptions, like Leonard Cohen. Like, nobody can sing a Leonard Cohen like Leonard Cohen. There are so many others that really... Honestly, there are other people who have done your work a hell of a lot better than you did.
Well, I always say Bob Dylan. Like,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Bob Dylan, covers of Bob Dylan songs are always better than... He's one of the great songwriters. I don't think he's a fantastic performer.
No. Nope.
I don't think he ever has been.
No.
But that's a whole other conversation.
He was in the Sioux and everybody was a little... I guess the performance wasn't up to... I don't know what people expected, because everybody loves his music, but I don't know what they expected. Yeah, no. You know, it's just like Joan Baez sometimes is not a great performer either.
Right.
But anyway, I think because the girl that was on, the woman that was, I can't remember her name now, she was on Carol Burnett's show. And she sang The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. I would say it was better than Joan Baez's version. But anyway,
it's just disappointing that we didn't get more of the Hayden relationship. And fundamentally, like, we're going to see Crystal a couple more times for the run of the show. They get married by Johnny Mathis. Like, it's
that's
a cute.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's
it's cute, right? Or no, they're Johnny Mathis's best man. They don't get married by Johnny Mathis. I got that wrong. But anyway, like, it's cute and all, right? It's all fun, but at the same time, it's not an interesting relationship, and she's not an interesting character.
Well, no, because
she never gets a chance to be.
Well, you know what she is, though?
Please.
She's the perfect wife for David Rossi.
Oh, absolutely.
If
someone who's going
really
to ask nothing from David Rossi.
Ask nothing from David Rossi. Enjoys playing poker, enjoys drinking, the whole thing, the very fact.
100%,
You know, they're both older.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And this is why they can get married now and still do those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was, and and she's got her own life, and she's always had her own life. So, you know, David Rossi doesn't have to worry about actually being a responsible
husband. No, they're just, I mean, they're old enough that they can just be casual with each other, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And so getting married is fine, but, you know.
Yeah, no, it's you're right. I think they're a good couple for each other.
Yeah.
One thing that bothered me about David Ross in the episode is that, again, there's no continuity here. They don't know about the characters. They've forgotten that David Ross, he likes video games.
I know. Oh,
how do they forget that?
Because
he plays video games. He loves video games.
Oh, okay, which episode? Which of these episodes is this? Oh, that was it. I have to go back to this.
Okay, please.
Okay. I mean, we'll get back to this episode in a second.
In a second.
Okay, yeah, but I have to go back. Okay, so you've got the guy, right?
Yeah.
The guy who's replaced Penelope.
Yes. Oh, we didn't mention him at all.
Okay, we didn't talk about him, right? Okay, and the thing was, I doubled over laughing, because if I hadn't listened to commentaries, this would have just flown right by everybody. And you would have just thought, right? He was, well, just this lazy guy. He said, well, you know what he did? He said, well, I can just give you all my passwords and everything, and you can do your own research. And I cracked up because of that stupid commentary with Erica Messer going, yes, and we have given the researchers the right to do their own research,
the
right?
To do their own research, How did we forget that?
I cracked up while
it's
I was watching
It's so funny.
That. And I have no idea whether Adam Rodriguez heard that commentary.
That line. Yeah, I know, and put that line in.
But it's like,
and the thing is, you can't. That's what the weird part about that episode. You're like, that has to be an attack on Erica Messer, right? The whole idea that just do your own research. We got rid of the research staff to save money. Like, you feel like it has to be an attack on her, doesn't it?
But that means that Adam Rodriguez then is very subversive.
Oh, God. Well, I mean, the whole episode, I think, suggests that he's fairly subversive.
Yeah. And the question is...
To what extent?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, again, here's somebody you would want to talk to. And
I would love to talk to Adam Rodriguez about this.
And the Stephanie Sengupta is the woman that is... the writer of it.
Of that episode.
She only wrote a couple of others this season, but she was...
Yeah, that line about...
But that line was just... I doubled.
Yeah, because that's exactly what we heard from Erica Messer.
And we know how well that works.
That has gone, I know. Well, you got to take money wherever you can, apparently.
Both Criminal Minds and for the BAU.
I know.
Right?
Oh, like, God.
You're sitting there going, is this really? Did he go back? Maybe he went back and watched
the previous
years as he was in this show and he'd listened to commentaries.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
It wouldn't surprise me to find out that Adam Rodriguez, that episode was born of him having watched the whole show and being like, we got to talk about some of this stuff. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But like I said, I've always loved Adam Rodriguez from CSI, from Roswell.
Miami.
CSI Miami from Roswell. Like, he's a wonderful performer. I'm a big fan of his. But after that episode, and that episode's wonderful takedown, I mean, we didn't mention this either. It is a takedown of the BAU and the show. It absolutely is. The crazy part is, a pilot I sold years and years and years ago, right?
Yeah.
It was something I wrote in reaction to Criminal Minds. Never got made. Don't worry. You don't have to think about it. don't worry, people. You didn't miss anything. It never happened. But I got paid, and that's what counts. But anyway, it was a parody of the Criminal Minds idea. And the funny part was, the central theme of the show was this idea that hunting serial killers is not an important or, you know, actionable activity. It's just a PR exercise by the FBI. That was the whole premise of the show.
And, okay, and that's in here too, you know.
And that's in here. That's what I was about to say. And that ended up in this episode. I'm like, thank God someone other than me noticed that.
Yeah.
Although we didn't even talk about the single dumbest line in the episode, which is JJ saying, 26 people have been murdered by serial killers while we were sitting on our hands. We could have saved 26 people if you just let us off our leash.
And guess what? No, they would never have found this serial killer if Barnes had not sent Penelope over to cybercrime.
Oh, isn't that an amazing coincidence?
If Barnes had not sent her to cybercrime, they never would have known this serial killer existed.
Actually, the one thing is, even if she hadn't, they would have gone and investigated that case once a senator's daughter had been murdered.
Yeah, but that would it would have been too late. Yeah, and besides, he was killing himself with her.
Yeah, actually, you're right. They never would have. You're right. He was going to kill himself with her. So you're right. Yeah, it just they would have just ended.
Yeah.
And it's not like he was planning to get away with it. He brought her to a hotel to murder her.
And then he was lying with her.
Yeah, no, he was absolutely not going to get away with that crime. You're right. No, you're right. Barnes is the one who actually, in a roundabout way, saved that woman's life.
Yeah, if it hadn't been.
I hadn't thought about it. Sorry, sorry we went back to that episode, but something else occurred to us.
Yeah, it was the research thing that all of a sudden got to my brain. I am starting to wake up again.
But yeah, I am legit. Thank you so much for remembering that, because I wrote it down in my notes, and then I neglected to look at my notes when we were talking about it, because yeah, the guy, that line about, oh, you can just do your own research. Oh, so brutal. And that's the kind of, and the thing is, that's a line that you wouldn't realize is brutal unless you knew how the show used to be run and had listened to the commentary. Well, friggin' Erica Messer says people are responsible for their own research.
Yeah. I mean,
you have to be
a
deep cut fan of the show to understand why that line is such a brutal takedown of Erica Messer.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, is this Adam Rodriguez is getting a paycheck for this?
Oh, absolutely.
So, consequently, is this his way of taking down the entire production of Criminal Minds?
Maybe.
Is he the only one? Who cares enough about what's going on?
Yeah. To point out this stuff.
As I have to. This is the only episode so far where you find it. Because I'm sitting here going, because that's part of what pisses me off. That all of these people knew.
Yeah. And Adam Rodriguez came in so late. It's not like he's responsible for this scumbag. But everybody else saw what this guy was doing and kept quiet about it.
You know,
and Adam Rodriguez dropped in at the 11th hour. Yeah.
They cared less about that scumbag. Clearly.
Fascinating. All right. So let's get to the actual episode we're here to talk about. it's one of those episodes. It's another one of those episodes that I always talk about where, because they establish an MO for the killer and how the killer did his crimes. But then they want to have a twist, and the twist invalidates the whole episode, which is, if Jason Gedrick was doing the murders the way they first think, I completely understand how he gets into this room with these women to murder them. Because they're big fans of his. Yeah. How is his wife getting at these women?
Well, yes, but this is written by CSI guy Bruce Zimmerman.
Oh, okay. So the episode making logical sense is not a high priority for CSI guy Bruce Zimmerman.
Yeah, no, he was the one that did CSI New York, wrote for CSI New York. But anyway, it has to be Jason Gedrick as the serial killer.
Yep.
Because he's the only one that would have been able to get
easy access to these women.
This strange woman shows up.
Yeah. Come into my house. And let's chat.
Say,
it doesn't make sense. No, it doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah. And the woman is so unstable.
Oh, yeah. Like, she can't hold it together at all. So how is she getting to these women? Like, no, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, and it's like one night after another, you know? And you're just going, I, yeah, the episode in many, 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 many ways just doesn't track
logically.
Unless Jason Gedrick is the killer.
He's the killer. Yeah, if he is, this episode makes perfect sense.
Killing these women so that there will be no barrier to his...
Yeah.
How this episode should go. He's killing these women so there's no barrier to him focusing solely on his wife as they renew their vows.
Yep.
And then they're all going to... And he's going to go away. And then here's the wife. And you can just see her in a state of shock because how I would have done it is they would have been exchanging their vows.
Yeah.
Before the BAU sort of
finds him. Yeah.
And then they swoop in and there's the poor woman whose husband has become a serial killer in order to get rid of these women who have kept him from being the husband he should have been.
Yeah. And he's blaming these women for his failures as a husband.
Yeah. And so by killing them, this means he will be able to be a proper husband to his
wife. Yeah. That's you're right. That works fine. That's the episode. You've just described what this episode should have been.
Yeah. And instead we get some ditzy wife that just don't buy it.
No, you just don't.
Yes.
Because you don't buy that she could have done this. And you don't, like, her motivation is so esoteric. Like, she's mad at her husband for cheating on her, so she kills people who write him fan letters.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a mistress, right? You could just, I'm not in favor of murder, but you could just kill his mistress. You're aware of that, right? Yeah, that part really bothered me, as I'm sure you noticed.
I mean, it just, the whole thing is yeah. And plus you don't set her up enough.
No, she's like in one shot in the entire episode.
And like,
she shows up, she reminds him about the renewal of their vows. She goes away.
Yeah. And then she comes out at the end as the killer. Well, no. How did she kill Jason Kedrick?
I know.
How did she get in there?
Yep. I guess she followed them, but how did she get in there to kill him? And how did she kill him? She was able to overpower two people? Yeah, like this tiny woman was able to overpower two people?
Again, it's a casting issue as well.
But I think the biggest issue is simply that it's like, because they were desperate to have a twist, they're like, okay, and then we'll have the twist. And they didn't stop to think, well, does the twist invalidate the entire episode up until this point? And if so, maybe don't do the twist.
Just don't do the twist. Make it Jason Gedrick. Yeah. It's not like all episodes have a twist.
No, episodes almost never have a twist. This isn't CSI.
That's right.
Episodes don't have to have a twist. It just has to be a situation where a guy is, you know, where a horrible guy is committing horrible acts. And then they swoop in. This whole last minute twist thing they've been doing really hurts the show and is very off brand for them.
Yeah, and it doesn't, and all the time when you're watching the show, it just doesn't work. That's the problem. The twist doesn't work because they don't really know how to do effective twists. For all that we hated in CSI.
You know, there's some fun twists on that show.
There are some really fun twists that come out on that show. Like just this one with the carp. Never mind.
Well, we can talk about that some other
time. No. I'm just saying, you know, I mean, you have these different things. And the funny thing is that CSI Miami didn't have as many of those twists.
Not as many, but they still liked their twists.
Well, yeah. But at
they
least
still their liked twists their made twists. Their,
but their twists made sense usually.
Often, although the secret code, in case you're wondering who did it, and if you want to figure out who did it in CSI Miami, and I'm sure I've told you this before, but just since it came up, if you all want to know, what happens is every time they meet anyone involved in the case, they have the character accuse that person of the murder. Every single person they meet, they accuse of the murder. And then all of them deny it. Because, you know, of course, they didn't commit the murder. And then one of the characters they meet, they won't accuse of the murder. And then that person will be the killer.
Yeah. No,
so,
there is a code.
So watch the person they don't accuse of murder invariably that's the killer. And if you're wondering, why is that? It's because they don't trust the audience to understand that a character was lying. So they just have the person who is the killer never get asked the question, because they're worried the audience is going to say, wait a minute, but they said they weren't the killer. How could they be the killer? Well, and I think that's massively underestimating the audience. But then again, I don't write for CSI Miami.
And who cares? And this show, it's like you've got to have two dead bodies and save the third. And every time stray from that,
they don't
know what to do.
That's
and it's just
right.
like here, doing a twist. This episode has a perfectly logical ending that one can rewrite very easily.
Oh, no, you can fix this episode. Like you said, 5 minutes in a typewriter, you fix this episode.
I fixed this episode.
You know? I literally just said you.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, it's funny because you're absolutely right. It's so easy to fix this episode. Just do the episode you wanted to do. Jason Gedrick's crazy and he's like, this is how I can recommit to my wife. There, done.
Yeah.
You've done the episode. And it's, again, completely logical that Jason Gedrick would be able to both A, get to these women alone, and B, make sure these women know to keep it a complete secret because he's married.
Yeah.
And they're fans of his and they're obsessed with him, so they'd go along with his peccadillo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, no, you're absolutely right that there is a version of this episode that isn't just better, it actually makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So.
So, yeah.
That's it.
Frustrating episode. Oh, and then at the end of the episode, I guess we should make it clear.
Yes.
Yeah, they do get back together. Him and Crystal.
Crystal. Ross
and as
Crystal.
We said,
yes.
It's a perfectly shallow relationship.
Yeah. They love drinking. They love playing poker.
Yeah. You know? These two are perfect for each other.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Absolutely. It may sound like we're being sarcastic, but legit, these two are perfect for each other.
Technically, no, yeah, we're not. These two people are made for one another, and they understand one another, and they have a good time, and they've got enough money to do it. Like, she would be an absolute if he didn't have any money, or if she was whatever, wanted to do the housewifely thing, or whatever, they wouldn't get along.
No.
You know, like, it wouldn't work, but...
Oh, absolutely.
They both got the ability.
These are shallow people who work well together.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to.
They care about one another, so what the hell?
I'm just thinking.
And they've always got that original story to tell. And his child is not any has nothing to her child has nothing to do with David Rossi. So
yeah, and his child has nothing to do with her. So yeah, it's all going to work out perfectly. For him. Like I 100% buy that part of their relationship.
Yep.
Yeah, completely. All right. So I guess that's that. Very, very mixed bag this week.
Oh, except that we did spend more time on the Last Gasp, Adam Rodriguez episode.
Oh, well, if we had to, come on.
Yeah, well, no, because it was just, and I can
I'm embarrassed that I forgot, no, but I'm embarrassed that I'm the one who completely forgot the most important line of the episode.
Yeah, and
thank you.
The thing is I didn't write anything down because I thought, well, I won't forget that.
Forget that.
Well, we were 3/4 of the way through this episode, and then all
we
of a sudden,
honestly,
went, ah!
If we would have had to go back and do a special episode just to talk about that line, if we had ended up completely forgetting about
another addendum.
That's what I'm saying. That's how important that line is to like what Criminal Minds has become.
Yeah,
we would have had to come back and do a whole other mini-sode about it.
Yeah.
All right. So that, as they say, is that. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you'd like to suggest we watch any profiling-related fiction, please feel free to drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you are listening to this on some sort of a podcatcher, please rate and review the show, because that is how people find it. And now we're going to find out what our homework for next week is. If you will, Dr. Redmond.
19.
Which is?
Ex parte.
Oh, which one is that?
This is the one where Simmons's wife is a hostage.
Oh, the Die Hard with Simmons. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. This is the Die Hard episode.
Yeah.
The next one is All You Can Eat.
All You Can Eat. Why are these titles blanking for me? Which one is All
Actually,
You Can Eat?
The important part of this episode is Garcia and her stepbrother getting together.
Oh, it's the Garcia and her stepbrother. No, and her stepbrother episode. Damn. Wait, yeah. No. Is it her stepbrother or is it her half-brother?
It says here her stepbrother.
Yeah, I guess it is her stepbrother.
I'm not so sure. We'll
watch the episode and see, yes.
There could be a problem with the, you know. Anyway, yeah. This is when Continue. Two people spontaneously bleed to death in Arlington, Virginia over the course of 24 hours.
And there's the guy poisoning people with anthrax in their salad bars. Right. Okay. Done. Yes. Yeah.
And then we have Mixed Signals.
Oh, that's the one about the hum.
Taos, New Mexico.
Yeah, the Taos, New Mexico hum. Yeah, that's a famous thing that this episode is about.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that next week. Okay. All right. I do remember the episodes now. Yay! this should be a time. This actually be fun next week because we're really going to be able to dig into who Penelope Garcia is.
Yeah.
Let's just say she doesn't come out that well in this episode.
Well, it's a tough situation, but it is
a tough situation, which we'll talk about next week.
Yep.
All right. So join us back here for that. But until then, I'm going to say that's right. Au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.